loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, a former CIA officer suspected by investigators of helping China dismantle United States spying operations and identify informants has been arrested. The reported collapse of the U.S. spy network in China is described by the New York Times as one of the American government's worst intelligence failures in recent years. Then we talk about a newly drafted United States nuclear strategy doctrine that has been sent to President Trump for approval that would permit an expanded use of nuclear weapons. This document is called the Nuclear Posture Review. We're going to take a look at that. And in our second hour, five stories. House Republicans are proposing another stopgap spending measure that would ignore Democratic concerns over DACA, but would fund the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, for the next 6 years. We'll look at whether the Democrats will be forced to choose children over immigrants to get a budget deal. Next, for 16 years, fighting in Afghanistan between U.S. troops and the Taliban has stopped when winter descends. Under the new rules of engagement, however, for the third U.S. president to administer the Afghan war, the U.S. and Afghan forces conducted an average of 15 airstrikes a day this December, compared with an average of 2 last December. The value of the dollar is down more than 15% versus the euro in the past 6 months, making exports cheaper and imports more expensive. It could also fuel inflation and prolong the stock market rally. But is this a bubble, and are the Trump administration's policies just kicking the can down the road? Next, momentum is building for an outdoor Virginia prison reform rally that will be held on Saturday, January 20th at Bell Tower on Capitol Square in Richmond, Virginia. On the same day that he refused to answer questions before the House Intelligence Committee, former White House senior advisor Steve Bannon was subpoenaed to testify before special counsel Robert Mueller's grand jury. He has now reportedly agreed to an interview with Mueller rather than to testify before that grand jury. We'll look at whether Steve Bannon is a witness or a target. But first, we turn to an arrest of a former CIA officer suspected by investigators of helping China, the People's Republic of China, dismantle U.S. spying operations in China and identifying informants who have been arrested. The reported collapse of the U.S. spy network in China is described by the New York Times as one of the American government's worst intelligence failures in recent years. We are joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. She is a former FBI special agent. In 2002, was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Welcome back, Colleen.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, the headlines are pretty striking. They're almost breathless, I would say, about the arrest of this former CIA officer who the indictment asserts was a double agent, basically, for the People's Republic of China, and helped identify informants and agents of American intelligence operations working inside of China. Anyway, it's a big story. We haven't heard from the accused, of course, and this is one of the parts of the story that I think is important, that we don't get to hear from the accused. We only get to hear from the accusers and from the media. But when you heard it, when you read the story, when you know of it, what's your take?
Well, this spying, of course, is ubiquitous. All countries that have the ability do it. And all you need to do is read a John le Carre novel to realize that it's going on all the time. There are things like double agents, and there even are things like triple agents. And, you know, when you have your informants and sources inside a country disappearing or being killed, as apparently happened in 2010, there is an immediate suspicion, and oftentimes that suspicion falls on people who are innocent. This happened before Robert Hansen and Aldrich Ames were identified. The CIA actually targeted one of its own employees and made life miserable for the guy for years, and he was totally innocent. And in the case of Robert Hansen, They had been warned and actually told by some people that Robert Hansen was a suspect, but the FBI disregarded the clues that had come in about him and appointed him to be on the head of the task force in charge of looking for the Russian mole. So when people say you have the worst intelligence failure, there's a lot out there that this would be in comparison with. And there's been, of course, 9/11 and all other things. There have been really a lot of intelligence failures, and this would certainly not be perhaps the biggest or the last.
Colleen, these cases involving classified information and defendants who have high security clearances can become very difficult because that classified information still has to be protected in court as the prosecution is presenting its evidence. So how does a prosecutor go about proving a case in a court of law where, unless the Classified Information Protection Act is invoked, this information is going to be made public?
Well, I think they do invoke that classification. I forget that you just mentioned it.
Yeah, CIPA.
And they use those procedures. They have sometimes they actually have proceedings that they do not allow the public to attend. They are, you know, basically kind of in secret. The attorneys, that's the key thing. The attorneys have to have security clearances, which very much limits the range of attorneys that one can hire. So there are all kinds of issues that way when prosecuting. But I think the thing to remember, especially when that argument comes up, that it's not possible, that we have to have commissions and, you know, we really have to develop a whole parallel process, is that the courts have been able to deal with these cases. And, you know, there are some problems with them, but they have been able to deal with them okay.
Let's just talk about the specifics of what's happened. The CIA apparently was noting that a number of the people who were working with the CIA suddenly were being arrested or executed.
Mm-hmm.
Or disappeared. And the investigation has been going on for quite a while. Mr. Lee, the arrested man, left the CIA, according to the government, in 2007. He was living in Hong Kong and working for a well-known auction house. He was apprehended at Kennedy Airport in New York on Monday and charged in a federal court in Northern Virginia with the unlawful retention of national defense information. In other words, he had classified information with him. But this wasn't the first time that Mr. Lee has been back to the United States during the time of the investigation. He had traveled to the U.S. in 2012 to live with his family in Virginia. It was during that trip, according to the New York Times, that the FBI agents searched his luggage during hotel stays in Hawaii and Virginia and found two small books and handwritten notes that contained classified information. He later made his way back to Hong Kong after being questioned by the FBI agents in 2013. Why then would he come back?
Yeah, he was questioned something like five different times by the FBI over the course of 2 months. And you're right, he came back. Why in the world would he do that?
You know, going back to the chronology here, it's not 100% clear from the newspaper accounts, but it looks like what he is charged with in terms of retention of classified information is actually those notebooks.
Yes.
That the FBI found in 2012.
Yes. Good point.
And if you understand this, well, the statute of limitations, well, usually it's 5 years. I'm not exactly sure what it is in this type of case, but the statute of limitations on something in 2012 would be running right now if it was 5 years. So it might be that again, if it is, in fact, this retention of classified information goes back to the 2012 searches that the FBI conducted, that really they had to lure him back into the United States at this point in order to charge him at all. There's a couple of curious things about the facts. Again, we don't know anything really very much except what the intelligence people leaked or told to the what's in the indictment and told to the reporters. But one thing that's not clear is, okay, he left the CIA in 2007, and apparently the disappearances were not noted until 2010 or 11. So that's 3 or 4 years after he had, you know, resigned from the CIA. That alone is a little bit strange, because usually when people resign or retire, they, after a while, they really no longer have any valuable information that they would be approached for. That's for starters. And secondly, so there is this long, pretty long gap of time here. And again, that we just don't know all of the details about this. One other thing is, were the notations in that book, the identities and the contact information that was classified and apparently in the book he had, does that correspond to the actual CIA sources that disappeared? Or are they completely different? I read carefully the article, kind of trying to figure out if that was the case, and there's no mention of that in the case.
Yeah, that's right. And I wonder if that's why they've charged him with really what comes down to a minor crime, retention of classified information. There's a maximum of 10 years in prison for conviction of this. It's a felony, but it's not you know, treason or one of the grave or more grave espionage charges. It's kind of a minor charge in the greater scheme of things, and it doesn't have anything to do with the disappearance of as many as a dozen sources, which then makes me wonder if they're going to add more felonies, more serious felonies from the Espionage Act at some later point.
Yes, that's exactly right. This could have been a rush job in terms of writing up an indictment quickly when they found out he was coming into the United States. That's kind of what the article that I read indicated, that this, they kind of rushed it. So they charge something that's easy that they have, and then they'll see what else they can maybe add on. That's possible. The other possibility is, as you said, they really don't have good evidence that they could charge him with espionage or treason. For instance, like Robert Hansen, the more serious charge, if they don't have that better evidence. If, for instance, the notations in his book do not correspond at all to the people who disappeared, for instance, that would be something that might indicate that's all they have. And going back to a reason, in my experience, people who retire, and especially when they think they're going to work later as a contractor, or for instance, if we're going to work like Chris Steele, and you were going to use your prior contacts that you had developed in the course of your actual career, but now you're going to go into private business and you think, oh, I want to keep a hold of those contacts because I might be able to use them to make money in my later career. And I think that there are some reasons like that why somebody could have notes from their job or even contacts of coworkers, et cetera. It's quite possible people would have, you know, innocent reasons for having those, fairly innocent reasons for having those, which would have nothing to do with actually then, you know, using those to engage in espionage with a foreign power.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Colleen Raleigh, a special FBI agent, retired, who was named in 2002 Person of the Year, Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. We're talking about the arrest of a former CIA agent, an American who was living in Hong Kong, accused, according to the media reports, of carrying out work for the Chinese government and exposing the identity of CIA assets inside of China. A number of them, according to the media reports, have disappeared or been arrested or been executed in China. This is big news, of course, dominating news in the media. And we're trying to understand it because, of course, the headlines seem, and I think people reading headlines seem to think it must be true, case closed. But, of course, we all know that people who actually understand this system, you have to, while we agree, as Colleen has pointed out, a modern statecraft includes spying operations by all governments on other governments and trying to recruit spies on from other countries and have those spies commit treason against their own countries. And there's also double agents and triple agents who expose the identities. That's all there. But that still doesn't help us. And it's important for us and for these kind of discussions to try to pay attention to the facts, because in the facts lies the truth. And it's very hard to get there. Now, I'm looking, Colleen, at the Global Times. The Global Times is a newspaper published that it's a private company, but it frequently is seen to represent the views of the Chinese Communist Party or the Chinese government. The headline of their article from today is "Witch Hunt in U.S. Endangers Chinese Community." And I want to read a couple sentences to you from that editorial and just see what you think about it. Here's the first sentence. The U.S. Justice Department announced Tuesday the arrest of Jerry Chun Xing Li, a 53-year-old former CIA officer, on charges of unlawful retention of classified information. Mainstream U.S. media outlets indicated that it was Li who led to some 20 U.S. informants being killed or jailed in China from 2010 to 2012. And then the article a little bit later down says, and just take another second, but I want to have you hear this. Li, a naturalized U.S. citizen, served in the U.S. Army in the 1980s and worked for the CIA from 1994 to 2007. In 2012, FBI agents found in his travel luggage two small notebooks with secret records of details such as, quote, true names and phone numbers of assets and covert CIA employees, close quote. Then the editorial continues. But how foolish could a former CIA officer be to simply place treasonous evidence in a travel bag instead of destroying it after the failure of U.S. intelligence on the Chinese mainland? The CIA officer exhibited a low intelligence and emotional quotient by not destroying the evidence. Now, whatever the the translation is there on that sentence, they're making light of these charges. They're saying this doesn't make sense that he's has the names of informants and CIA assets who he turned in who have been killed or arrested by China, but he keeps them in his travel luggage and takes them back to Washington, to Virginia.
But there's one other point in this piece too. I found all of that fascinating and important, but toward the end of the piece, it says China is different. It never puts intelligence gathering above overall diplomacy, nor does it turn overseas Chinese into informants.
Well, that's nonsense.
That is patently nonsensical. But yeah. Go ahead, Colleen.
Yeah, I think all countries are trying to gain information in all different ways about other countries. Again, read some John Le Carre novels to understand how this is not, our news paints it all always very one-sided. The track record in catching, you know, if you think about the tip of the iceberg, the number of double agents who are actually caught has to be a lot less than what is actually going on. That's just the nature of the beast. And especially if you know the story of Robert Hansen, you know, for 20 years engaging in espionage and Aldrich Ames and everyone else. And even when there's suspicion, it's incredible. The intelligence agencies do not have really very good ways of detecting. Eventually, people who are working, sometimes, especially the ones who get very cocky after a while, think that they know how the system works enough, and they can. And that's exactly the case of Robert Hansen. He thought he was above it all. You know, after 20 years, he thought he knew how this was working. Now, this case would be the other extreme. If he was not keeping, you know, critical notes and carrying him with them on trips, et cetera, that would, you know, seem to be very stupid. On the other hand, you had former Defense Intelligence Agency Director Flynn actually, you know, talking on the phone and then later, not telling the exact truth about that phone conversation. And of course, he would have had to know that everything was always being tape recorded, which is also, you can't exactly explain sometimes things by saying, oh, somebody would have been smarter than that, et cetera. And I think that a lot of this goes on. I don't think they catch very much of it. Also, they are wrong many times. And I think the biggest question I have in my head is the importance of these notes and as to whether they correlate with anything. again, if they were just plain notes that somebody was keeping, names of coworkers, they said undercover, so that would be a coworker. If these things were just being kept as possibly of use for me once I leave the agency, that I might need to get in contact with someone, and I'm just keeping this information for my own purposes, that is definitely a possibility, and we really don't know enough to rule that out as to whether this truly was a case of espionage. And I think that's kind of the biggest area that I think would have to be clarified in order for us really to pronounce one way or the other.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, this is another thing, too, that so many Americans either don't know or ignore, that all we have now at this point are allegations from the prosecution. Oftentimes, those allegations are hyperbolic. They are not able to be proven. The prosecutors throw it out there to influence the press, perhaps to influence the jury pool. We only have one side of the story so far. We should probably reserve judgment until we have the other side of the story as well.
And if he has classified information with him of any type, he's culpable. And thus, whatever happens, even if he was a minor figure or wasn't the person who was identifying agents and assets, and he might have been, but even if he wasn't, they're going to be able to come up with a plea here. He's going to plead guilty to something. And we don't know what the purpose of that plea would be. In other words, it could be for many different reasons that the government would want a guilty plea. Maybe just to say, we did it, we found the culprit, or there could be more to it as well. We just don't know. One thing Colleen, and I'm glad you brought up in the beginning that all governments do this. So we have to approach this, you know, without sort of rose-colored glasses on from any side. When I went to Cuba last year for the funeral of Fidel Castro, we did this show down there. I met with a pediatrician. He was a very mild-mannered, low-key pediatrician who had for many years worked as a CIA agent in Cuba, but all the time he was a Cuban double agent. And he described how he was sent out and he went to Mexico and his father was an official in the Department of Health, the Ministry of Health, and interested in Fidel Castro's health. And he went to Mexico and he complained about the Cuban government. And the CIA at a conference asked him if he would defect. And he said, no, I have criticisms. I have differences, but I would never defect. And then Cuban intelligence sent him out to Mozambique 2 years later, and he made more complaints. And this time they approached him once again. And he said, well, yes, the whole thing was a trap. They were trapping the CIA. And it turned out that all of the, not all, but maybe all of the Cuban CIA agents were in fact Cuban double agents. That was the WASP program. And they had completely infiltrated the program. And this is what's going on behind the scenes. Both countries are realizing that there is a war of sorts going on. And in many cases, it's a hot war or it's a covert war, but it's always a war in terms of recruiting spies or exposing spies. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is, like I said, it's just real. And especially in the people who are good at this in the spy world, John will be able probably to back that up, people who are recruited to be undercovers, even in the FBI, they have a set of skills, but those set of skills also, in some cases, make them impervious to polygraphs. People like Aldrich Ames were able to pass polygraphs because we talk about conscience, but in fact, their skill set, which is what makes them good at this constant, you know, not really aligned with loyalty, but like always, you know, going back and forth. That's going to make a higher incidence of this kind of thing. And I think that one speculation here that just occurred to me while we were talking is that if the government has this, you know, very slam dunk charge because they found a notebook from 2012, what they might be in a position right now is because they don't know. If you're in a case where you really don't know something, you can charge someone, you know, threaten them with a 10-year prison sentence, and then hope that you will learn if the person insists, no, yes, I had those notes, but this has nothing to do with the people who disappeared. But by putting the person in that position, they may be able to ferret out more. And I think that would have been the argument made for quickly arresting him if they truly did not have more information about that. This might have, you know, just have been a technique. Because if you go back, there isn't really good ways of ferreting out. And the reason you can just look at the track record, look at the history of trying to figure out who was Aldrich Ames, who was Robert Hansen, Ivan Nicholson, all these others who actually engage in this for a number of years. And, you know, where the CIA mistakenly goes after wrong people, the FBI goes after wrong people. The history here is that it's not easy to find these things out. And so, again, I think it's a good guess that they maybe arrested him just as a way, as a method of trying to find out more. It's possible.
You know, that strikes me as entirely plausible. Maybe they just don't know the whole story at this point, and arresting him is the only way to get some of those answers. Perhaps they can even offer some sort of a deal, which they likely will in the end, in order to have those questions answered. That makes total sense to me.
One of the reasons I think the Chinese, well, in addition to the general animus between the People's Republic of China and the U.S. on many of these fronts, there's also the case of Wen Ho Li. He was accused of of stealing secrets about the U.S. nuclear arsenal for the People's Republic of China. He went through, he went through hell. And
it turned out he ruined his life, and he
was innocent.
And he was innocent.
But you would never know it from, again, people just look at the headlines. They think, well, it must be a done deal. The government obviously knows what they're doing, or they're obviously telling the truth. Colleen Raleigh, you're familiar a little bit with Wen Ho Li. Talk about that, if you would.
I keep mentioning these other fiascos. I think someone should actually write a piece about all the mistaken suspicions and the mistaken times where the intelligence community has targeted the wrong person. Some cases, like Stephen Hatfill being accused of being the anthrax killer, he was able to collect $6 million afterwards. But in many of these cases, I think Wen Ho Li is one of the cases where he was, you know, mistaken, but actually never, you know, I don't think they even apologized.
No, they never issued an apology. He wrote a book called My Country Versus Me, where he was finally able to tell his side of the story. But the Department of Energy, the Department of Justice never apologized to him.
That's right. And to some extent, racism and national origin probably plays a role. I read a lot about the anthrax killer, and there were cases at Fort Detrick where other scientists were targeting, different other scientists that had different ethnic or national origins. It was almost kind of a racist type thing. So there was this almost juvenile bullying of people that went on at even professional levels. And so when you're layering that on a situation where there is suspicion, it's a natural, I shouldn't say natural, it shouldn't happen, but there is some susceptibility to falling into going after a Wen Ho Li because, he must be the one because he's the one who is of Chinese origin, or the Arab in the room. Well, they must be guilty of this because they are, they must be loyal to whatever. Then this does happen. It happens, of course, with blacks too. And so I think that we need to reserve judgment. We need to look at this really sordid track record of the intelligence agencies not doing this accurately and not, of course, jump to conclusions that the government is correct, because there have been a whole series of cases where they haven't been. If this Li ends up only being charged in doing a couple of years for improper retention of his notes or whatever, I think that will be a clue that they really never had anything more. But we'll have to wait to see those things.
Wise words from Colleen Raleigh. Avoid the rush to judgment. Reserve judgment. Wait for the facts.
And that's the voice of experience right there.
Exactly. Wen Ho Li spent 9 months in solitary confinement during the time he was incarcerated. Finally, the federal government paid him $1.6 million or something. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We want to thank Colleen Raleigh, former special FBI agent who joined us. She was named in 2002 Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. After a short break, we'll be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
A newly drafted United States nuclear strategy that has been sent to President Trump for approval would permit an expanded use of nuclear weapons. This document is called the Nuclear Posture Review. The following is a 30-minute excerpt from an interview on the issue of nuclear weapons. The program was recorded 1 week ago in the studios of Radio Sputnik here in Washington, D.C. with Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, and with Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog of the organization Beyond Nuclear. Greg Mello, welcome to Washington, D.C. What brings you here?
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here. Well, I'm here to prevent the construction of a new Rocky Flats plant, which would enable the acquisition of new kinds of nuclear weapons in the U.S. arsenal and be a threat to world peace. So that's what I'm doing.
And are you hopeful?
Medium. There's quite a few people in Washington who have been around long enough to treat with skepticism the so-called requirements to produce new nuclear weapons and the cores of nuclear weapons. This is what we're talking about. They're little atomic bombs, and maybe not so little. And they're hard to make, and they are in some ways the critical step in making new kinds of nuclear weapons. And the United States has 23,000 of these cores. Some are in deployed weapons, some are in reserve weapons, some are in retired weapons, and some are just in storage. There may be about 16,000 or more pits in storage in Texas.
Is the argument that the Rocky Flats plant is obsolete, it's too old, that it needs renovation for security purposes? Because it would seem on its face that this idea of building newer nuclear facilities with little nuclear bombs, these cores, would be on its face in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, because the idea is, the quid pro quo being, that non-nuclear powers are determined not to gain nuclear technologies for nuclear weapons production in exchange for the already existing nuclear powers incrementally getting rid of their nuclear weapons and then ultimately getting rid of all of their nuclear weapons.
Isn't that the whole idea behind the NPT?
Exactly. But the NPT is not really followed here in the U.S. or the other nuclear weapon states. They think the NPT is just for non-nuclear weapon states. So the uncertainty, so Rocky Flats plant closed, well, it closed partially in 1989 with a raid by the EPA and FBI. They were in massive violation of environmental laws.
And in fact, there were criminal charges that came out of that, weren't there?
There were, but I don't know, nothing was ever.
Right, it wasn't
nobody
resolved.
Ever, yeah, the Rocky Flats grand jury left very disappointed in how their findings, their evidence was used and what was dropped. And so it all quietly went away. I don't think anybody served any time or anything. And then they finally closed the plant after trying to restart it in 92. And it became a cleanup site. And since then, the United States has not had an industrial level plutonium warhead core factory. Russia has such. And the reason we don't is partly because the sacrifice made by the time Rocky Flats closed, the standard of craft there was very high. The workers sacrificed themselves, basically, to produce very, quote, high-quality nuclear weapon cores, and they last a very long time, a century, approximately. And so there's no need to make them. The Russians had a different philosophy of changing the stockpile, keeping the workforce busy. And so they are changing them out all the time because they don't last that long. And so as a result, they have surge capacity, which makes U.S. militarists and generals very nervous. And this disparity has been at the core of the neoconservative idea that we've got to have a big factory.
Okay, Kevin Kemps, this week, President Trump has to decide whether to certify whether Iran is indeed in compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Arms Deal. President Trump has been insisting that North Korea, which may have 6 nuclear weapons, presents a grave danger to the United States and to world peace. It's interesting what Greg Mello said, that the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, as interpreted by the nuclear powers, is only applied to those that don't have nuclear powers, or that those countries that the nuclear powers don't want to have nuclear weapons. In other words, they're out of compliance.
That was one of my favorite parts of the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony, was Beatrice Finn and the survivor Setsuko Thurlow from Hiroshima calling out the nuclear weapons powers on their hypocrisy and their essentially violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so it even gets worse than that. Here you have a country, Iran, and I'm no fan of the Iranian regime, but they did have the right under the NPT to develop a so-called Atoms for Peace nuclear power program. And yet countries like Israel and the United States under George W. Bush were threatening war against Iran for pursuing what Iran was claiming was a electricity supply from nuclear power. So here we go again. I mean, the crises are by the hour, by the day with the Trump administration. And President Trump on Friday, I believe it is, will decide whether to certify or decertify Iran's compliance with the nuclear agreement, not just with the United States, but with several countries. And if Trump decertifies, it's going to lead to the United States being in non-compliance with this nuclear agreement. There are major powers that have signed this thing, including Russia, including European countries. And so for the United States to walk away from this thing, it's going to have repercussions, and it's just going to add to conflict and crisis in the Middle East, as if there isn't enough already, with, you know, wars raging in various countries in the Middle East with some of these same players, these essentially vying for power enemies like Saudi Arabia and Iran and others in proxy wars as we speak in various places. And so it's just going to pour more gasoline on the fire.
There's a number of issues here. One is the danger of nuclear war, the danger of nuclear accidents, the danger of a conflict getting out of hand, so that even though no side wants a nuclear confrontation, once people start climbing the escalation ladder, the other side has to have a countermeasure. In some ways, people think, I believe, there's kind of a passivity about the issue of nuclear weapons now compared to, say, the early 1980s when there was a great, great alarm and Reagan was encircling the Soviet Union with intermediate and tactical nuclear weapons, some of which had a 6-minute flight time to their targets at political offices inside the Soviet Union. A big peace movement grew all over Europe, and it had its component here in the United States. We had a march on June 12th, 1982 of 1 million people in Central Park. But the passivity right now is premised really on the feeling that we're not in danger. There's not going to be a nuclear weapon, that all of that talk was maybe hyperbole, that all is well. Is it well?
Not at all. I mean, there are thousands of nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert between the United States and Russia alone. And I just read Dan Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, where one of his points in his long career as a nuclear war planner was the United States planned to take out the Soviet and then Russian military command and control infrastructure was a pretty unwise thing if you want to stop a small-scale nuclear war from going full-scale. And so, you know, Rebecca Solnit made the point, you just raised the Central Park rally with 1 million people against the nuclear arms race. The mistake that the movement made in the United States was a lot of people kind of went home when the Soviet Union fell apart. Those weapons remained on hair trigger alert. They still do remain on hair trigger alert now. And with the, you know, the tension in the world, North Korea, of course, being the current hotspot, but we just talked about Iran as well. People need to engage. There's a lot at risk. It's you can't overstate what's at risk right now.
Greg Mello, why are the weapons on hair trigger alert? I mean, why? It doesn't look like feel like we're on the edge of the apocalypse.
Two minutes to midnight on the nuclear clock or whatever it is. Why? Why are we on alert?
Because the Air Force couldn't really deploy ICBMs if they weren't on alert. They would have no raison d'etre. And so there's a whole group of senators that would oppose getting rid of them. And there's financial interest, political interest involved. There's not really a strong strategic interest. In fact, it's a negative strategic interest. They're vulnerable to hacking. And this is from General Cartwright, who was head of the Strategic Command and knew what he was talking about. He says, if you think they can't be hacked, you're wrong.
In fact, it was General Cartwright who was able to oversee installation in the Iranian program of the Stuxnet virus.
Correct.
So if General Cartwright can oversee hacking of a system like that, certainly there are others out there who can hack into our system.
Correct. And now we see that there's a vulnerability in all Intel chips.
Literally all.
Yeah. And this should make people worried, and we should be standing down until this is resolved, and then we should get rid of these things. We have William Perry, who was Secretary of Defense, who says they make us less secure, not more. So this is a big opportunity. We should take it. We don't need those things.
In fact, didn't Kim Jong-un say just, 2 days ago, Brian? He actually seemed surprised that people thought that North Korea's nuclear weapons were for use against South Korea. And he said that he would never launch a nuclear attack on his Korean brethren. North Korea's nuclear weapons were to protect itself from the United States, which is a hostile power to North Korea and has nuclear weapons.
Well, North Korea was part of the NPT regime. It was a member state of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and subject to intrusive inspections. And then January 2002, George W. Bush, having trashed the Sunshine Policy of Kim Dae-jung, which had led to a thaw and people hoped a normalization of relations between North and South Korea, Bush trashed that. Kim Dae-jung, the South Korean president, came in March 2001 and Bush treated him rudely, et cetera, et cetera. Then September 11th happened, and Bush declared in January 2002, there's an axis of evil, and that axis is Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. And everyone knew who was paying attention that the U.S. was getting ready to go to war against the first part of that axis, and that would be Iraq, which had subjected itself to weapons inspections, had disarmed itself, in essence, and thus would be low-hanging fruit for an invasion. And then the North Koreans said, okay, we get it. We're going to leave the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we're going to get a nuclear weapon because we don't trust you. Because you might say one thing under under Bill Clinton, you know, there was an attempted normalization at the end, but the next guy can come in and turn it all around. So the only thing that can guarantee our security is our own nuclear presence. I mean, since then, things froze. That's why this happened.
An amazing part of the whole history here, you mentioned the Axis for Evil speech. I happened to catch on C-SPAN radio, because you can turn your radio on in the car and get C-SPAN radio in Washington, D.C., and they were interviewing Bush's speechwriter, David Frum, who came up with the phrase Axis of Evil. And what he said in that interview just floored me. He said, yes, Iraq, yes, Iran. And North Korea was added as an afterthought because they didn't want to appear to be anti-Muslim. And you said it.
That's so funny, because they added North Korea to the travel ban so it wouldn't look like a Muslim travel ban.
So there's a history here. And, you know,
that's an amazing. I didn't know that.
North Korea's response to that, after seeing what happened in Iraq, you know, with the execution of Saddam Hussein after the invasion, seeing later what happened in Libya with the execution in the street of Muammar Gaddafi, North Korea took some steps, you know, and in 2006, they exploded their first test blast. And so there are consequences to this kind of imperial behavior, essentially.
We've talked about that on this program, as a matter of fact. If you look at Muammar Gaddafi, he did everything right? He saw the invasion of Iraq, and he said, oh boy, the Americans invaded Iraq because the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction. Whether they did or not was irrelevant. But that was the reason. I better give up my weapons of mass destruction. And so it was Gaddafi who reached out to the CIA and said that he was ready to give up his weapons.
Well, he got busted.
He got busted.
There
of course
was a
he did.
Uranium enrichment facility.
Sure, of course. And everybody knew it.
En route.
Everybody knew it. But a senior CIA officer went to Libya and negotiated the dismantling of the program. And we still turned on him. And he died like an animal in the streets. So that has to be a message to every other world leader who is not on necessarily good terms with the United States and either has or is considering a WMD program. I mean, do you give it up and still risk being overthrown and executed or assassinated? Or do you just maintain the program and take your chances with the Americans?
And it's a part of that history, too, of the United States and other nuclear weapons powers, depending on things to this day, decades later, like deterrence. So here's North Korea, depending on nuclear deterrence, as the United States has explicitly done for many decades now.
You know, Greg Mello, I can remember reading Michio Kaku, nuclear physicist, his book, To Win a Nuclear War. He co-authored the book, but they had gotten, the authors had gotten classified documents back about the Korean War, the Forgotten War. Some of the documents revealed that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had taken a unanimous decision around April or May of 1953 to begin using nuclear weapons against North Korea and parts of China unless the DPRK and China signed the armistice that would bring the military conflict to an end. This was a decision taken because the North Koreans didn't want to sign it. They wanted to keep fighting. They figured, you know, we've endured the worst. We want to evict the Americans and the others from the southern part of our country. And then perhaps it was China. We don't know. We don't know why, but the armistice was signed about 2 months later. But it appears from those documents that if the armistice had not been signed, the U.S. was prepared to actually carry out the nuclear annihilation of North Korea. Now, the North Koreans know all this. I mean, they didn't need the classified documents. They didn't need to hear that we had read Michio Kaku's book. They know. So when Donald Trump gets up at the podium at the United Nations and says, I'm prepared to totally annihilate you, for the North Koreans, that has not just the ring of a maniacal, maverick, political operative, Donald Trump, but it seems institutionalized, or at least the American government was prepared to do that. Now, North Korea has never been prepared to, quote, totally annihilate the United States, but they certainly have been the recipient of that kind of decision making.
Certainly. And during the Korean War, they were pretty much annihilated. There were almost no conventional targets left, not one stone left on another. The tonnage of bombs was enormous. And there was also mass slaughter of civilians that took place when people were fleeing south because the U.S. forces felt they couldn't discriminate between civilians and soldiers sometimes. So there's a lot of things that have been hushed up about that war.
Let's talk about the evolution of nuclear weapons from the point of view of the geostrategic use of these weapons, not simply to go to war, but also to threaten war, to intimidate. In August 1945, at the time that the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the U.S. had a monopoly on nuclear weapons. And so I believe the U.S. felt, you know, we're going to get our way in world politics. The Soviets had just lost 20 or 27 million dead. They didn't have a nuclear weapon. It seemed like the ace in the hole for American post-war plans. The Soviets were obviously rushing to gain their own nuclear capability, and then soon thereafter, the People's Republic of China did the same. But it seemed like in the beginning part of the post-World War II era, the idea that these weapons could be used and used and used again was very operational because they had been used. In other words, there was a feeling that it wasn't a moral or ethical determination not to use them. It was like, we can use them because we can use them. And it was only when the Soviets perhaps developed either nuclear parity or some kind of capacity to hit back that there became an equilibrium about nuclear weapons where there was the mutually assured destruction concept. Now we have the United States. It seems to me, and I could be completely wrong about this, I want to get both of your opinions. Is the United States actually seeking to go back to an era, I can't get rid of the other country's nuclear weapons, but go back to an era where military supremacy is such that nuclear weapons or the use of nuclear weapons actually becomes an operational concept once again? Is that part of the thinking?
for some people, but not a majority of people. I think
that's
that,
good.
Yeah. I think that the process of preparing the Trump nuclear posture review has been one of weeding out crazy ideas gradually, week by week, over the summer and fall last year. And those, I think that that type of thinking is not at all dominant. Just a few crazies out there, of course. But they have a place in this administration, unfortunately, that's bigger than in the previous administration. But there still is a doctrine of compellence along with the doctrine of deterrence. And that is semi-official. So the Defense Science Board has used that phrase actually comes from a report by the Congressional Research Service. But the Defense Science Board has referred to this idea before. And the idea is you threaten and you have nuclear weapons as a kind of an aegis of power over your expeditionary forces so they can't be defeated. So it's like the Air Force uses the analogy of fighters above the bombers, the top cover. So it's the top cover over U.S. expeditionary forces, escalatory control. So the idea is that with this in place, then we can coerce and we can get the political, diplomatic, military outcomes that we want. And that remains very much in place.
And Kevin Camps, let me just go back to you. It's not just Donald Trump. We had the Obama administration also modernizing the nuclear arsenal, a big, expensive modernization. Why would they do that? Is it simply to keep the weapons safe, secure, in other words, not getting too old? Or are they starting to consider battlefield options for nuclear weapons, perhaps of a different type, maybe smaller or lower yield or adjustable yield nuclear weapons? What's the modernization for?
Right. $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization over 30 years, probably more than that. So, really it comes down to actual new weapons designs with new military applications, which again is another violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty commitments, another escalation. And some of these proposals are very destabilizing. So for example, a nuclear tipped cruise missile that an adversary could not tell whether it's conventional or nuclear until it explodes. And so they may make a decision to respond thinking it's nuclear with a nuclear response when it was only a conventional cruise missile. These are the kinds of destabilization activities that the United States is undertaking.
That's crazy. I mean, what's the thinking there?
Well, like Greg said, there are some nuclear hawks who have played roles during the Obama years, now certainly during the Trump years, who get their way sometimes. And the nuclear weapons labs in this country are, and Greg can speak to this more than I can, are a very, very powerful political player in this country. And they demand billions per year, and they want to see that gravy train keep rolling for decades to come.
Yeah, I think we're already seeing, actually, a manifestation of this. There's an article that was just published moments ago by Newsweek saying that the Trump administration is planning to develop a new, what they're calling a low-yield version of the Trident missile. It would be nuclear-tipped, and it would be placed on U.S. submarines to use tactically as a part of normal battles. This is something that was shunned. The very idea was shunned by the Obama administration. But one of President Obama's arms control and proliferation assistants, John Wolfstahl, is saying that he's already seen the most recent draft of a new Trump policy review, indicating that the U.S. plans to start developing this small nuclear weapon.
This is consistent with everything that I've heard as well. And I think we can expect this on January 19th. And the unfortunate, well, there's a lot of unfortunate things about that. It's stupid strategically. It's quick to do because it doesn't really require, I think it's pretty quick. I mean, you could do it with wire cutters.
Sure.
And so it's, you know, it will, it's stupid because it reveals the location of the Trident submarines when the first one is launched. There's overflight issues. There's all the issues that Kevin brought up of confusing what's actually going on. It looks a lot like a nuclear strike. I mean, like a big nuclear strike, an all-out nuclear war. So, you know, it's crazy. And I guess we have our work cut out for us in fighting this and other things we may see on week from Friday.
And talk about Friday. Why? Just for the audience that may not be paying attention?
January 19th, we expect the Nuclear Posture Review to be released. Okay. And then we'll have all these ideas in detail, and not just one or two people will have them.
Before we go to a short break, just how does the Nuclear Posture Review take place? What are the different agencies and institutions? How long does it take place? How often does it happen?
I think it's sort of irregular. It involves all the national security actors to one degree or another. It's been an all-year process. Headquartered in the Pentagon, Rob Suffer is in charge of it. He used to be John McCain's nuclear weapons person in the Senate, in the committee, Senate Armed Services Committee. And so it's been coordinated among all the agencies.
Go ahead, Kevin.
And that just happens to be the same day that the government either shuts down or doesn't. So the Trump administration...
Can we shut down that part of the government?
At least.
Yeah, before they do the wrong thing.
Yeah. How much is the United States spent on nuclear weapons?
Well, I mean, there's a great book called The Atomic Audit from many years ago. And at that point, the estimate was $7.5 trillion, which is a big fraction of our national debt.
It's more now, both from inflation of that figure and then everything we've done since. So it's really other than the rest of the military, it's really the largest post-World War II expense up to the end of the Cold War. It dwarfs everything else. It was a vast treasure.
It's amazing when you think about it. I mean, it's hard to think about it, actually. It's hard to wrap your head around it. The nuclear era began in 1945, really, in terms of its demonstration, August 1945. We've spent $7.6 trillion before. Now it's, who knows, maybe it's $8 trillion, maybe it's $9 trillion. And a trillion, we don't even know what a trillion is. I mean, it's just too many zeros. And it's for a program that the only time the weapon was used was in August 1945.
Well, actually, Dan Ellsberg made the point in his book, The Doomsday Machine, that the weapons are used all the time. They're used like a gun in the hand of somebody who's robbing a bank. They hope to not have to pull the trigger, but they might.
And there's an identity between those two things, because where they're really pointed is at the American people. They're pointed at the appropriations process. Mm-hmm. There's the fear.
That's a good point.
The fear that's inculcated keeps the money flowing, and not just for nuclear weapons, for the entire military establishment. And so that's, you know, that's really, I think, their primary use.
All right. We have 60 seconds to go before we go to our break. Kevin Kamps, what could we spend? What could we do with $7 trillion? I mean, just think about it. I mean, just think about what
Imagine.
All the, I mean, we have a situation where one out of every two Americans is either in poverty or close to poverty. Those are the numbers.
That's actual not just, figures.
Yeah. I mean, you have bridges crumbling. You have highways. We don't have adequate trains. I mean, just think of what—
Airports are international embarrassments.
And outside of using nuclear weapons like a gun in the hand of a thief who says, give me your wallet or else, society gets nothing from this.
Well, the American Society of Civil Engineers most recently gave a D+, I think it was, to U.S. infrastructure, which is having some impacts like that train derailment out west recently. So imagine what it could be used for, turning around the climate catastrophe that's at our door. There's another idea.
Yeah. And really, the loyalty to the Pentagon and the sort of the myth of national security allows the public debate to be so terribly muted on this. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a very short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.